We have a smaller group today than yesterday, which is fine. And I want to begin with a story about grace. It was cold that winter. Pennsylvania. Very cold. Many nights the temperature hovered near zero. The snow would fall, only to turn to ice before it came again. And for days and weeks on end, the cold continued to grip our corner of the world, and the snow kept falling, and people began to ask, will this winter never end? And I would reply, just wait. The daffodils will soon be in bloom, and then the red buds, and then the dogwoods. Jan says I'm the eternal optimist. I suppose I am. I routinely climb out of bed with a smile. I can't wait to get to my work. I relish every day. I look forward to what the day will bring. I look on the bright side unless there's a compelling reason to do otherwise. And there's a reason I live this way. I passionately believe in God's unmerited grace. I really do believe that if God is for us, who can be against us? But for years, I had no idea of how liberating grace can be. When I was in high school, I had endless arguments over guilt and grace with my Baptist buddy, Dan McKeever. Dan told me that God's love is so great and so compelling, there's no way we can escape it, even when we sin. For that reason, Dan said, once you're saved, you're always saved. I told Dan that was sheer nonsense, that when you sin, you fall out of grace. When you beg God to forgive you, you're back in a state of grace until you sin again, and on ad infinitum. The way I saw it, the human soul was like a ping pong ball that bounced in and out of grace maybe 100 times in the course of a day, maybe 1,000,000 times or more in the course of a lifetime. Not until I was a sophomore in college did I hear the gospel of unmerited grace for the very first time. That wondrous event occurred in the midst of a course in the book of Romans at Harding College in 1962. The professor, Jenny Allen, was lecturing on Romans chapter 8, verse 2. There is therefore now no condemnation to those who are in Christ Jesus. When the teacher read those words, he waxed warm and eloquent. In truth, he began to preach. No one, he said as he leaned into the lectern toward his students, no one can possibly be good enough or smart enough or right enough to earn or deserve salvation. We are saved, he affirmed, not because we're good or right or perfect, but only through the unmerited grace and favor of God, who loves us and accepts us in spite of our sins and our failures and our utter imperfection. Salvation, he said, is the gift of God's infinite love and grace. Virtually all of the 120 kids in that class, almost entirely from Churches of Christ, were incredulous. That speaks volumes, doesn't it? As Alan began to unpack the meaning of that verse, we had never heard anything so radically affirming. And Alan's words, and the biblical text that informed his words, spoke directly to my guilty heart. And I left the classroom that day with an ecstatic feeling of liberation. Those words set me on the road to freedom. Freedom from self-reliance, and freedom from the conviction that I had to be perfect if I had any hope of salvation. But the road toward freedom would be a long one. So deeply etched into my heart and my mind was the compulsion to live a life of perfection. As it turned out, Alan's proclamation of the biblical message of grace had the very same effect on the other 120 Church of Christ kids who were in that class that day. Jan, my future wife, included. And that night, a revival broke out in the Harding College dorms. A revival marked not by weeping and wailing, but by a celebration over the fact that God's grace had lifted our mutual burden of guilt. And then a few years later, at the University of Iowa, one of my teachers, Professor George Farrell, helped me grasp the Christian vision of grace even more fully. In a class on the theology of Martin Luther, Farrell explained how for Luther, the gospel is fundamentally a paradoxical message, which Paul knows all too well. For Luther, Farrell explained, the heart of the gospel lies in the fact that as Christians, we never cease to be redeemed, though we never cease to be sinners. Sinful and redeemed simultaneously, Farrell explained. What a paradox. Simul justus et peccator. When Luther advised his followers to sin boldly, Farrell explained, he wasn't advising them to sin with abandon. He was telling them to accept the inevitable truth about themselves, that they were sinners. And as I listened to Farrell, I began to accept that very same truth about myself, that I am a sinner too, inescapably, inevitably caught in the universal human web of greed, self-interest, and hubris. I knew then I could never accept God's grace until I accepted myself, with all my frailties, all my faults, all my sins. The proper equation was not sin or grace, as I had believed for all those years, but sin and grace. Luther was right. Simul justus et peccator. As I began to grasp what Luther meant, I began to realize I didn't need to be perfect, but I did need to trust God's pledge that His grace was sufficient, even for someone like me. And that's why I knew that the death of winter would morph into the full-blown glory of spring, that daffodils would don their yellow bonnets, that magnolia blossoms would fill the air with the aroma of spring, that purple lace would coat the red bud's limbs, that exquisite petals of pink and white would transform the dogwood trees into radiant heralds of all that was yet to come. It was all a matter of unmerited grace. Some years after I discovered grace, my life took a turn that put my belief in God's unmerited grace to the ultimate test. It was June of 1998. Jane and I had traveled to Door County, Wisconsin, for the annual meeting of the Institute for the Study of American Evangelicals, a group of historians who specialized in the history of American religion and especially the history of American evangelicalism. It had been an unusually busy and tiring year, so Jan and I arrived in Door County, Wisconsin, several days before the meeting began, just to rest and relax and enjoy one another's company. When daybreak dawned on Father's Day of 1998, neither of us had an inkling that the day would end with a devastating heart attack that would place me in the hospital for almost a week. That day was an extraordinarily special and memorable day. We drove the scenic roads, and we poked around in the picturesque villages of Door County. We visited craft shops, historical sites, country churches. As dusk was falling, we stood on the shores of Green Bay, watching the sun work its magic on the western sky before it finally settled beneath the horizon. Jan says, on a scale of 1 through 10, she would give the day a 20. Back in the room that evening, we checked out Sleepless in Seattle, my all-time favorite movie, an appropriate choice, I suppose, for an eternal optimist. But only minutes into the film, I didn't feel so well. When we called the doctor at a local walk-in clinic, he advised that I likely was having a heart attack and should call an ambulance immediately. And my response to the news, underscored the sense of self-reliance and hard work and perfectionism that still defined my life in so many ways. Here's my response. Some weeks before we left Door County, Grant Wacker, you know Grant, professor at Duke Divinity School, you know him too, I'm sure, David, and at that time the editor of the journal Church History, had sent me a copy of Bill Martin's, With God on Our Side, The Rise of the Religious Right, along with a note, would I please review that book for the journal? I promised Grant I would read the book and get the review to him soon. So I took the book with me on our trip, thinking I would complete my reading during the course of the trip and then write the review as soon as Jan and I returned back home to Pepperdine. When the heart attack struck and the ambulance arrived, this is so ludicrous I can hardly believe it. My first thought was this: what a great chance to make progress on this book. The paramedics placed me on a stretcher, hooked me up to all kinds of tubes, wheeled me after the ambulance, but I've still got my book. And once in the ambulance, I began to read. Jan, on the other hand, was following the ambulance in her car, driving late at night down roads that were new to her, not knowing if I was dead or alive. Once we reached the small county hospital of Sturgeon Bay, Wisconsin, Jan began to make calls to relatives and friends, telling them that Richard had suffered a heart attack and asking for their prayers. But I, in the examining room, was still reading my book. I read for 2 or 3 hours until the doctor came in and said, "Mr. Hughes, all the evidence suggests that you've suffered a severe heart attack. But we can't determine that for sure at this little small county hospital, so with your permission, we'd like to put you on another ambulance and send you to Bellin Hospital in Green Bay. There they can make an accurate determination and treat you accordingly. It's a cardiac center for that part of Wisconsin. Is that all right with you?" "Certainly, Doc," I said. But in the back of my mind, I was thinking, this is great. I get another hour to read my book. So they connected all the tubes. They wheeled me up to the second ambulance. And as soon as we began the drive from Sturgeon Bay down to Green Bay, I again whipped out my book and began to... I'm like on page 200 now. I'm just making progress. And then, some 10 minutes into that ambulance ride, the attending nurse spoke 3 words... that would change my life. She looked at me and she said, "Are you nuts?" Her words were to me a great revelation. Sacrament. Sacrament. Grace working through the ordinary. Are you nuts? A revelation. I didn't have to read that book. As a matter of fact, I never did finish it. I never wrote the review. But her words also prepared me for what was to come over the course of the following week. In Green Bay's Bellin Hospital, we would learn that the right side of my heart had simply stopped beating, forcing the left side to do all the work. In spite of a variety of measures the doctors took to stimulate the right side of my heart, it just lay there in my chest, unresponsive, for the better part of the week. And I completely understood that I might never leave that hospital alive. One of my thoughts was, "Lord, if I have to die, can I not go back to Malibu to do this? Really, in Wisconsin?" Typically, in our 40s or 50s, we come to terms... Come on down to the front where you can hear well. Typically, in our 40s or 50s, we come to terms with the fact that life won't last forever. The point often lost on youth. And as that inescapable truth settled into my consciousness during those middle age years, I often wondered, how would I respond if and when I found myself staring the angel of death squarely in the face? And now, here I was, not only looking death in the face, but with the angel of death staring me down. And I was amazed at my response. I had so completely internalized the Christian doctrine of unmerited grace that we are saved not by getting our theology right or getting our act together, but by the infinite love and grace of God. I had so completely internalized that phenomenal truth that I accepted the fact of my possible death with complete equanimity. I lived a rich and full life for 55 years. If the time had come to go, then the time had come to go. But the King of the universe had said yes to me. And that was really all that mattered.
Lunch with Madeline. It was February of 1981, and we were living in Springfield, Missouri. I noticed in the morning paper that Madeline L'Engle would be speaking at convocation at a small church-related college. Their rather unimpressive campus was located in a somewhat over-the-hill part of town and faced onto a positively ghastly street jumbled with telephone poles and tacky signs. I thought, what? That's not good enough for Madeline L'Engle. I could easily imagine her speaking at Harvard or Stanford or maybe even Pepperdine, but not at this seemingly undistinguished school. However, nothing could have kept me away. I quickly changed my day's plans and headed to the far side of town. I entered a low-slung, barracks-looking building and saw that the students had the best seats in the house for this required meeting. I squeezed in near the back and waited in anticipation. I delighted in the sight as she strode in, her six-foot frame draped with a wonderful cloak, looking as if she had just stepped out from the pages of a well-loved storybook. And when she spoke, it was as if all of her books opened to me at once with tremendous clarity and congruence. After her presentation on Christianity and the arts, she proceeded to a small anteroom for an autograph session. Most of the students made a beeline for the next class, but I joined a small group who waited for Ms. L'Engle to seat herself at a rickety card table and sign our books. I had come prepared. I cradled an armload of well-loved books she had authored. First, my own little tattered paperback of Circle of Quiet, which she inscribed in her beautiful calligraphic script to Janice, a sharing of the circle. And Ladder of Angels, a wondrous retelling of Old Testament stories with illustrations from children around the world, she inscribed to our son. For Andy, visions of angels and unicorns and all God's loveliness. And for my husband, The Weather of the Heart, a book of poetry, which I would say for Valentine's Day, also beautifully inscribed, for Richard. May you be a long-loved and long-loving love, Madeline L'Engle. After the signing, I lingered and visited with several members of the college's English faculty, none of whom I had met before. I was informed by one of the professors that a small group would be taking Ms. L'Engle to lunch, and they graciously asked if I would care to join them. After approximately 1 second of careful deliberation, I broke the suspense with a resounding, yes, I'd love to. Remember, I had such difficulty picturing Madeline at this small, conservative, seemingly undistinguished college. Yet I knew that she moved with grace and seeming ease across a broad landscape of people of faith, consistently gathering people together for conversation rather than dividing people into opposing camps. And in spite of myself, I discovered that the small school was much more substantive than I had ever dreamed. I enjoyed both the place and the people. But now I shifted gears and began to wonder about lunch. Where would they take Madeline L'Engle to lunch? Springfield provided some excellent choices, and I thought of several obvious local establishments offering both great food and a certain ambiance. Maybe we would go to Wicker Works, perhaps the new McSalties. No, they said, it was to be Chinese food, one of her favorite cuisines. Oh, Chinese. Well, certainly we'd be going to the venerable, elegant Mr. G's on East Sunshine. Perfect. but wrong. Instead, we headed south on Glenstone, the ugly street, and pulled into a tacky little former gasoline station, converted but not disguised, a little hole-in-the-wall place that looked as if it were designed only for carryout. I hope I concealed my embarrassment. How could they have picked this place for Madeline Lengel? Didn't they understand? This was Madeline Lengel, Newbery Award winner, a wanderer who voiced the questions I didn't even know I had. This was Madeline Lengel, whose faith questions became my questions too, even though she asked them from a different part of the theological spectrum. Her books, ranging from personal journals to fiction, fantasy, science fiction, and poetry, are filled with themes of family and community, time and space, physics and astronomy, faith and doubt, mystery and miracle, good and evil, icon and image, light and dark, sun and shadow, naming and unnaming, story and song. Chronos, chronological time, and Kairos, nonlinear time, run side by side and over and under each other. Her characters reflect the congruency of her own life, her own quest, and they ring with authenticity. She has stretched and enriched my world and been my companion on the journey. She has been my true mentor, and I love her. Listen to her celebration of the power of naming, the utter joy of creation. Be, caterpillar and comet. Be, porcupine and planet, sea sand and solar system. Sing with us, dance with us, rejoice with us for the glory of salvation. Seagulls and seraphim, angleworms and angel hosts, chrysanthemum and cherubim, be. Sing for the glory of the living and the loving, the flaming of creation. Sing with us, dance with us, be. This was Madeline Lengel, and we were taking her to a barely disguised gas station for lunch. This place was not charming. It was too nondescript to be appalling. Oh, my, oh, my. But there we were. And so I shifted gears once again and decided to ignore the restaurant and spend my time in anticipation of the wonderful conversation we would have around that table. Just as I would go anywhere to hear her speak, I would eat anywhere just to sit at table with her. I was going to sit down to lunch with Madeline Lengel and be part of a conversation sprinkled with all the delicious words that she had added to my vocabulary: ontology, tessering, wisa, widdershins, kairos, chronos, hubris. Who cared what we ate? We would speak of icon and image, time and space. I knew. Guess what we talked about? Mundane things. Everyday things. The same kinds of things half the world talked about yesterday at lunch. Household chores, dishwashing, cleaning, time management. I definitely did not need my dictionary for this conversation. I was irritated and frustrated and disappointed and absolutely shocked. How could we let this conversation go on? When were we going to get to the good stuff? How could these people have invited this woman to have her leave her rarefied life in New York City, travel to our small town in Middle America, sit at this table, and talk about things we all dealt with every single day? And then I finally got it. These women, gracious and generous hosts, had invited Madeline Lengel to Springfield because they loved her books. They had trusted her enough to take her to a place where the food was actually quite wonderful and to her liking, rather than to a place that would impress her or me. They had cared enough to permit her to be real with us, really with us. This Madeline Lengel, whose writing flowed from her everyday life, had through her books authentically shared the story of her journey, filled us with stories of her struggles, her losses, her celebrations, her victories, and her defeats. This was the same authentic woman who now sat with us and knew how to communicate about washing dishes. She really was with us. Certainly, she could have spoken to us of Kairos and Kronos and Hubris and Wisa. But on this day, the mundane, the everyday, was blessed by the presence and participation of this fellow pilgrim. And so we sat, half a dozen real women, on a winter's day in a humble establishment. We broke bread together, and it was delicious. And we did not pretend to be something we were not. Such was lunch with Madeline. I am so thankful they invited me. Next time, I'm sure we'll talk about Wisa and Kairos.
I told you yesterday that when our first year seminar at Messiah College, our students in that class evaluated the class at the end of the term, their response to the question, what did you like best about this course, was a unanimous, Jan. Some 43 years earlier, Jan elicited a similar response from one of my professors at the University of Iowa. This was no ordinary professor, mind you. This was Sidney E. Mead, the widely acknowledged Dean of Historians of American Religious History in the 1960s. Mead's reputation was the reason I selected the University of Iowa for my doctoral work in the first place. But as it turned out, I majored in Reformation studies at Iowa instead, not in American religion at all, and therefore never took a single course for credit under this extraordinary teacher and scholar. But while I never studied under Mead at Iowa, he became my teacher for the next 40 years. Our relationship began when my major professor, James Spaulding, asked if I would team teach a course with Mead at the United School of the Church, a summer study retreat for mainline Christians during the summer after my graduation from Iowa. My sectarian roots and Mead's Unitarian faith meant that neither of us had all that much in common with the mainline. So he and I spent hours that week getting acquainted. Our relationship blossomed until he died on June the 9th, 1999. Mead and I kept up a lively correspondence, exchanging four or five letters every year for the better part of three decades. How foolish I was to pass up the opportunity to study with this immensely learned and creative man became all too apparent during the course of my comprehensive exams. At Iowa in those days, the comps gave five different professors the opportunity to grill a doctoral student over the highly specialized subject areas that each of those professors taught. If the student passed the comps, then he or she moved on to write the dissertation. But if even two of the five professors flunked the student, that student was gone, out of the program. I was comfortable with the first four examiners since all four represented my major field of Reformation studies. And for the most part, I breezed through their questions with ease. But then came Mead. I had dreaded this encounter with Mead since I'd done no formal work under his direction at all. And it didn't take Mead long to discover my deficiencies. To make matters worse, I grew increasingly nervous once his line of questioning began. Mead asked questions designed to get me to talk about the shape of religious pluralism in the American Republic, one of the subjects to which he had devoted his entire career. But to each and every one of his questions, I froze and drew a complete blank. Finally, in frustration with the incredible level of my stupidity, Mead said, "Now look here, Hughes, I'm going to ask you one more question, and I'm going to make this question as simple as I possibly can. If you were walking down the street in downtown Iowa City, and someone came up to you and asked, "Pardon me, sir, could you tell me where is the church?" What would you say? He emphasized the word "the" when he said "the church," as if to give me one last and very important clue. He hoped I would somehow latch on to the obvious point that the term "the church" makes no sense in America, where there are many denominations and sects, but not a single established church. The obvious answer to Meade's question, but the answer that kept somehow eluding me, was simply, "Which church?" The room was deathly silent as I pondered Meade's weighty question for at least 2 full minutes. And finally, I blurted out with what was really more of a question than a statement, "Well, Dr. Meade, I suppose I would say on the corner." "Ugh!" Meade said, as he hit his forehead with the palm of his hand. He pulled a book off the shelf beside him and he began to read, as if to signal his complete disgust with my imbecility. He clearly had no more questions. In retrospect, I'm sure he must have failed me on that exam, but thankfully, a 4 out of 5 vote to pass a candidate was sufficient to move that candidate on to the dissertation. As a child of the Churches of Christ, I likely struggled with Meade's question because deep inside, I still believed at some subliminal level there truly was only one legitimate church, and I simply resisted the implications of Meade's line of thought. At any rate, that evening, I told my wife Jan about the exam. I told her that Meade had asked, "What would I say if someone asked me, where's the church?" "Which church?" Jan asked. During our week together at the United School of the Church, I told Meade of Jan's response to the question, "Where's the church?" From that day until the end of his life, he always contended, facetiously I often thought, but now I'm not so sure, that Iowa had awarded the PhD to the wrong person. "We should have given the degree to Jan," he often quipped. And as time went on, he came to know Jan and liked her a very great deal. In 1998, Jan and I were living right here in Malibu, California, where I served as religion prof at Pepperdine University. In June of that year, in the midst of a marvelous vacation in Door County, I suffered the heart attack that I just described to you. And following my recovery, I wrote to Meade and told him the story of this extraordinary adventure. I told him how the heart attack had occurred while Jan and I were watching Sleepless in Seattle in our hotel in the tiny village of Fish Creek, Wisconsin. How we called a doctor in another village, Sister Bay. How the ambulance arrived and took me to a small county hospital in Sturgeon Bay. How another ambulance finally took me to Bellin Hospital in Green Bay for treatment. And after telling this lengthy story, I shared with Meade what I viewed as the spiritual dimensions of this crisis. My letter was dated September the 1st, 1998. Exactly 1 month later, on October the 1st, 1998, Meade responded. He appreciated my story. "Still in all," he said, and this is a quote now from Meade's letter. "Still in all," he said, "by the time you got to Bellin Hospital, I had almost forgotten you in wondering where Jan was and what she was doing. Did she drive you on the first 2 laps? Did she ride with you in the ambulance to Bellin or follow in the car? And after you were settled in Bellin, did she have to go back to Sister Bay to settle with a hotel and with the purveyors of Sleepless in Seattle? Whatever, she must have been sleepless in Door County all night and much of the following 5 nights while your heart was deciding to go to work again. I'm tempted to be more proud of her than you say you are proud of yourself." Direct quote. Just prior to the heart attack, in fact, on the plane that flew us from Los Angeles to Door County, I read the marvelous book Tuesdays with Maury. Mitch Albom, who wrote the book, had lost touch with his old Brandeis professor, Maury Schwartz. And after a 15-year period of no communication, the two reconnected as Maury lay dying with Lou Gehrig's disease. And the title, Tuesdays with Maury, reflects the fact that Mitch and Maury met each and every Tuesday for the rest of Maury's life to explore together the meaning of life in the face of Maury's imminent death. Even though Sidney Mead and I had stayed in touch by mail every year for almost 30 years, I had actually not seen him for perhaps a decade. The Tuesdays with Maury made me realize that my chances to see Mead face to face were growing increasingly limited as the days passed by. So I called him. I told him I wanted to fly over for a visit. He and Lily were living in Tucson then. He told me he'd be happy to see me. He told me he had just celebrated his 94th birthday and, what was more, had just had his driver's license renewed. The next time he renewed his license, he said he would be 99 years old. He never got that far. A few days after my call, he wrote in a letter of, quote, "Our proposed visit sometime around the middle of this month. It would be, will be wonderful, a blessing to see you, to talk about anything from Tuesday's questions to recent gossip." So, sometime later, I made the short flight from Los Angeles to Tucson. We had what I thought, was a wonderful visit that lasted perhaps 3 or 4 hours. He and Millie even gave me some diaries written by Millie's mother, a Pentecostal preacher in Minnesota in the early 20th century. They wanted me to get those diaries to the Minnesota Historical Library. I told them that I would. 4 months later, Mead was dead. He apparently died of a broken heart, crushed by the changes that were overtaking his Millie, the love of his life, and a victim of Alzheimer's disease. I will always be grateful I made that trip to visit my old professor, and I will always remember the last words I heard from his lips. When I checked my watch and realized that my flight back to Los Angeles was coming up soon, I told him and Millie that I'd better be on my way if I wanted to make my flight. Mead got up from his chair. He walked me to the door. He walked slowly at a pace befitting a 94-year-old man. We stood on his porch. I told him how much I'd enjoyed my visit. We exchanged a few other pleasantries before I walked from his porch to my car. And then, as if to cap off those 30 years of wonderful interaction and correspondence, Mead spoke the last words I ever heard him utter. He spoke loudly to make sure I could hear. He peered at me through eyes grown dim with age, and then, without so much as a smile, spoke simply and directly. "Next time," he said, "send Jan." And I understood. And I still do understand. For Jan has graced so many lives, his and mine, and those of our students who were unanimous in their praise of her wit and wisdom and the stories she shared with them and with me, as she has helped all of us to learn to tell our stories.
Our trip to Padan Aram, or if you're a biblical scholar, you probably say Padan Aram. Mm-hmm. But in my home, growing up, it was Padan Aram. There was a time that when you opened the drawer of the bedside table in the motel, you found two things, a local telephone directory and a Bible placed there by the Gideons. In this day of smartphones and internet access, that drawer is usually empty. But in an inn in Danbury, Connecticut, I found both items, and so my search began. My fingers knew the drill quite well. Go to the yellow pages, look under the letter Q, and hope that there is a bold heading of 6 familiar letters, Q-U-I-L-T-S, quilts. Richard and I have been in quilt shops up and down the coast of California, on leafy New England lanes, and even in the small market town of Dorking, England, a short train ride south of London. Though Richard has never held a needle in his hand, he has always encouraged this particular part of my creative spirit. Those quilt quests have taken us on the back roads, the blue highways, the unbeaten paths, we often discover much more than quilts. A recent new acquaintance was very curious about our love of back roads, journeys with no particular destination other than exploration. He asked me how we kept from getting lost. I quickly replied, "Oh, we don't get lost. How can you get lost if you don't know where you're going?" But this day, we did have a destination, the local quilt shop in Danbury, Connecticut. I picked up the small pad of paper to jot down both the name of the shop and its address. The name of the shop was rather predictable and unimaginative, The Quilt Shop. But I was stunned by the address, number 5, Payden Arum. Payden Arum? What an unusual name for a street. And then memories flooded back from childhood. I remembered sitting in a circle with my parents and 3 sisters for our evening devotional. We often read from a thick blue Bible storybook called Hurlbut's Story of the Bible. I delighted when it was my turn to read the bedtime story. And now more than six decades later, a name from those days jumped out at me, Payden Arum. "Look at the name of this street," I shouted to Richard. "It's Payden Arum." Richard failed to catch the reason for my great delight, so I repeated, "It's Payden Arum." Richard remained unimpressed, so I continued, "It's in the Bible. It's in the Old Testament. I think it's in Genesis." My brain continued to go deep into its memory vaults until it came to the name of Jacob. "I think it has something to do with the town associated with Jacob." At that point, I lifted the Gideon Bible from the bedside table and turned to the book of Genesis. My eyes quickly skimmed its pages until I came to Genesis 28 and the story of Jacob's search for a bride. His father, Isaac, sent him on a trip designed to take him away from the local Canaanite women. Isaac told Jacob to go to the distant home of his uncle Laban to find a suitable bride. And then the name of Laban's home leaped off the pages of Genesis, for Laban lived in Padan Aram, or Padan Aram. But why did Danbury, Connecticut have a street with that rather unlikely name? As soon as we entered the nearby shop, I began inspecting the rich array of fabrics that spilled from its shelves. But Richard was not looking for fabric. He was looking for answers. He struck up a conversation with the gentleman who owned the shop, asking him if he knew why the street was called Payden Arum. The owner responded by saying that Richard was the first person who had ever come into the shop who knew the correct pronunciation of the street's name.
Wrong.
But Richard continued his probe. "Do you know why it is called Payden Arum?" His answer, "Oh, yes. It's an old Indian name. It's from the Native Americans." Richard gently responded that it was actually a geographic place name from the Old Testament story of Jacob. At that point, the proprietor called to the back workshop where his wife was busy with another customer, a local elementary school teacher. "Do you know why this street is called Payden Arum?" And back came the same response. "It's an old Indian name. It's from the Native Americans. We teach that to the local school children every year." And then it hit Richard, the church historian, that it was likely a name from the earliest English settlers of this region of New England, the Puritans. And because many of them came from England, and because they saw themselves as God's new Israel on these unexplored shores, they dotted the landscape with names with which they were quite familiar. Those Connecticut Puritans settled Glastonbury, Bristol, Lyme, Windsor, New London, New Britain, Norwich, and Plymouth. And from the Bible, they chose the names of Bethel, Bethany, Bethlehem, New Canaan, Goshen, and even a street called Payden Arum. No, not a Native American name after all, but a name with echoes of other times and other places, all of them part of our story, our faith story. No, you can't get lost when you don't know where you're going. But you can find yourself in the most unexpected places when you stay connected to your story.
I didn't think I would have time to read this.
You do.
Okay.
It's short.
The Nester and the Pilgrim. I am a Nester, but I married a pilgrim. Richard retired from Pepperdine 10 years ago and almost immediately accepted a full-time post-retirement position at Messiah College in Grantham, Pennsylvania. We agreed that was surely the last stop on our journey, although I had told a friend in Abilene, Texas in 1986 that my next move was straight up. Shortly after that ill-advised declaration, we accepted an invitation to return to Pepperdine after an absence of 12 years. My friend did not let me forget my earlier conviction that Abilene was our last move. I quickly responded that many people thought that Malibu was paradise. Well, 18 years later, we left paradise for Pennsylvania. And after 9 lovely years in that rather idyllic setting, Richard retired once again, and we pulled up roots and resettled in Franklin, Tennessee in the fall of 2015. Once again, retirement didn't quite take, and Richard is now scholar in residence in the College of Bible and Ministry at Lipscomb University. And this fall, the two of us will once again be given the opportunity to teach an honor seminar for first-year students, a seminar entitled, rather predictably, Learning to Tell Our Stories. Jose Ortega y Gasset wrote these words, "Tell me the landscape in which you live, and I will tell you who you are." We might present Señor Gasset with a bit of a challenge, but y'all come see us. You hear?
That's great. Thank you all for coming.